Welcome to Lethal Autonomous Weapons, 10 Things We Want to Know. This is episode 9, How Will Lethal Autonomous Weapons Change the Future of Armed Conflict? You're listening to an interview with Kenneth Payne, hosted by Paola Gaeta and Obimonu George Jai.
So thank you, Private Ryan, and hello everyone. I'm Paola Gaeta, Professor of International Law at the Graduate Institute in Geneva, where I lead a research project on lethal autonomous weapons and war crimes. And I'm here today with one of my research associates.
Hi, folks. I'm Abhimanyu Georgen, or Abhi, a PhD candidate at the Graduate Institute and a research associate on Paola's project. Over the last 8 episodes, we've looked at what lethal autonomous weapons are, how they differ from existing technologies, and how they raise new regulatory challenges. In that process, we started to wonder about how this technological change might affect the idea and practice of war, or in more technical legalese, armed conflict.
So this is the question we wanted to take up in this episode today. How will lethal autonomous weapons change the future of war and the future of armed conflict? To help us understand this matter, we are joined today by Kenneth Payne. Kenneth is a reader in international relations at King's College in London, where his research focuses on political psychology.
Kenneth has recently published 2 books that speak exactly to this question. This year, he published a book called I, Warbot with Hearst. And in 2018, Georgetown University Press published his book, Strategy, Evolution and War.
So as you see, Kenneth is very well placed to help us understand the question that we will be discussing today. So welcome, Kenneth, and thank you so much for agreeing to speak with us.
Thanks, Paola, and hi to you both. Hi, Abby.
So, Kenneth, let's start with a very simple question. Why should we be concerned about the changes that lethal autonomous weapons, or warbots, as you call them, might produce in warfare?
Yeah, I think big changes are coming as a result of greater autonomy and greater artificial intelligence used in warfare. But I think that the public perception can sometimes be a little bit misguided on that. You always see a newspaper article with a picture of Arnie as the Terminator. And I think people have unrealistic expectations about what artificial intelligence is going to mean, what it's going to be able to achieve. They think it's going to be a superhuman sort of intelligence. And as you probably know, and as many of your readers know, we're not quite there yet. In fact, we're a long way short of that. So that's point one. Point two, I think nonetheless, even given that, with the AI that we have today, the AI that we'll have over the next few years, we're going to have some profound changes in warfare. And we're starting to see some of those things feed through right now.
Right. A key part of your argument, Kenneth, as I understand it, is that AI or artificial intelligence is a decision-making technology rather than a weapon. And as I understand it, this feeds into your analysis of how lethal autonomous weapons might change the future of armed conflict. So could you start us off by telling us what you mean by AI being a decision-making technology rather than a weapon?
So, it's a general-purpose technology or a dual-use technology that you can apply to all manner of tasks, not just those involved in warfare. So AI is going to do a lot for the military that doesn't have to do with lethal autonomous weapons. You know, it can make a contribution to activities like recruitment, human resources, administration, payroll, medical processes for serving personnel, those sorts of things as well. But its application to warfighting, I think this decision-making aspect of it is absolutely critical. For the whole of recorded human history and prehistory, decisions about what to do in warfare have been taken by human minds. In fact, I make the argument that human minds evolved partially in response to the pressures of warfare. But now, for the first time, there's a decision maker involved that wasn't subject to those human evolutionary processes and that makes its decisions, whatever they may be, along wholly inhuman lines. And that's my starting point. That's my jumping off point for thinking about what the implications of AI are for warfighting.
You mentioned, Kenneth, that there is a difference between a human decision-making and artificial intelligence decision-making in warfare. But can you elaborate a bit more on the differences between these two processes in taking decisions on the battlefield?
So if you think about human intelligence and how it's applied to warfare, you think about human intelligence as an emotional sort of intelligence. Our emotions shape how we process information, how we decide what's important and how we act. And obviously, warfare is a very emotional experience. So combatants sometimes experience fear, anger, rage, even positive emotions like joy. They also experience fatigue, stress. All these things can impact on their decision making, and artificial intelligence isn't susceptible to those very human emotions. But instead, artificial intelligence makes its decisions in a very narrow sense. What artificial intelligence is good at are some of the things that humans struggle at. That's finding connections or patterns in very large data sets, remembering those connections very accurately through time, and making their decisions at blisteringly fast pace. So AI has some strengths relative to human intelligence, but it also has some profound weaknesses relative to human intelligence as well. And that's in things like grasping meaning in the same way that that humans do instinctively. From the time we're toddlers, we understand cause and effect in a way that is very intimately related to our what psychologists call embodied cognition. It feels like something meaning to us. It doesn't do that to a machine. So there's a paradox here. The things that we find hard, statistics, accurate memory, speed of decision making, the computer can do really well. The things that we find easy or instinctive, trying to figure out what somebody else is thinking using our powers of empathy, say, the computer isn't so good at. So they're two very different intelligences at work here. And I think there are some important things that flow from that into the arena of war and warfare.
Right. If we could turn now to some of the specific ways in which you suggest that military applications of artificial intelligence could change warfare. And one of these is shifting the balance of the battlefield away from defenders and in favor of attackers. Could you explain this for us a little bit, please?
Yeah, so this is one area among many of considerable speculation in the field. And I actually think we're arriving at the point where the armchair theorists like me, who sit there and try and figure out what's going to happen next, have to give way to active experimentation. So in this, as other areas, the balance between offense and defense is partly, largely even, going to be determined by what are the particular capabilities at work. How does this set of robots or automatic systems fare when it's put against this set of robots? And ultimately, you don't get to find that out until you actually have a battle. As Lawrence Friedman, the strategic thinker, says, power is revealed in the moment. You don't know how things are going to work out until you're there. But what I wrote about the offense-defense balance was that I thought it was going to shift in a pronounced way in favor of the offense. So you're right, Abby. And the logic there was, it has to do with this business of swarms. So one of the key attributes of artificial intelligence is it's scalable. It doesn't take years to train a new automatic pilot, for example. You just clone the algorithm and create another aircraft. So you can create mass, and you can create distributed mass spread throughout the battlefield. And that's the swarm, which many people think is going to be a big part of the AI warfare landscape in the years ahead. The attraction of the swarm is it comes together rapidly to concentrate power in time and space against adversary vulnerabilities. And so that should allow it to create a situation of overmatch, of superior force ratio at any one point, so that it can overwhelm the group of people, the group of machines that it's trying to attack. And so if that's the case, if there are no effective countermeasures, that's a big if, then that gives you something approaching what theorists call a first mover advantage. The side that goes first has the initiative. They can decide when, where, and in what strength to attack. And if they're using great mass and it's distributed, so it's hard to counterattack, that gives them a distinct advantage. So apologies for the long answer. It's got a number of ingredients in it, but that's the gist of what I'm saying about the balance of offense and defense. And as I say, there are a number of big ifs in there as well.
Thank you so much, Kenneth. You have just referred to swarms, and I just wanted to point it out to our listeners that in our last episode of the podcast, we will be talking about swarms. Now, going back to Abby's question in relation to the shift in balance of the battlefield away from defenders towards attackers, I think that there is also a shift or a change in the global balance of power more generally. Can you explain that? What do you think about that?
Sure. I think my starting point there is the dangers of technological determinism. I mean, oftentimes when you see writing about AI, it gets caught up in the sexy technology and the rapid advances in whatever field it is. And it's almost as if the technology arrives from nowhere out of the blue and has a massive effect on the societies where it comes. And theorists in strategic studies refer to that as technological determinism. And it's a big no-no because technology is created by cultures, and cultures differ both across space and through time. And AI is no exception. I think the way in which different cultures imagine AI, innovate it, instrumentalize it, adopt it within their armed forces in this case, and use it in battle will differ from country to country. And then, in addition, moreover, the ability of countries to do that will have an effect on their fighting power, on their effectiveness. So some countries that you would consider to be powerful military actors now will be less able to adopt effective AI than others, and that will produce changes in the balance of power. And usually when you get changes in the balance of power, there's a certain amount of unpredictability and some instability in the system, and that gets people worried.
Okay. Another change that you identify in your book is that lethal autonomous weapons may shift our attitudes towards risk. And how does that work?
Yeah, I think the basic argument here is that if you're not putting your own people in harm's way, you might be more willing to use force. Whereas before you'd have thought carefully, you know, do I really want, in the phrase, boots on the ground? What's the political cost going to be if we start losing our own people? And if we think back to Clausewitz, the great theorist of war, in his book On War, he talks about one of the animating features of warfare being the passionate hatred of the societies involved. Well, these days, for sort of technologically sophisticated countries in the liberal West, you don't often see that passionate hatred. There's, in fact, more of a sense of disconnection between societies and the wars we've been involved in the last several decades. So it's not that societies are motivated to fight by their hatred of the enemy. If anything, they're motivated to fight by a sense of humanitarianism less charitably, perhaps, of protecting their interests abroad. But these aren't existential wars as the Second World War was, for example. So the problem here is not passionate hatred. The problem here is risk aversity. Societies are very reluctant. Maybe it's not a problem. Societies are very reluctant to use their own force, to use their own people in war. The question is, what happens when you get more autonomous armies? Will they become more willing to use force in a range of causes?
Then do you also support the argument that if lethal autonomous weapons make it easier to go to war, they also make it easier to kill in war, what some commentators call a sort of video game mentality to killing? Would you also agree that this technology extends to facilitating that cognitive shift?
Yeah, so on the one hand, you could make that argument. I think humans in general find it difficult to kill. There's plenty of evidence that soldiers find it very a stressful experience to kill at close range. So the argument is that the greater the range, the easier it is, the less personal involvement people feel, and maybe there is something to that. Set against that, humans still find it traumatic to kill even at range, and so pilots of uninhabited aerial vehicles, drones, report significant levels of combat stress, even though they're a long way from the action. And also set against that, I think actually using autonomous systems in warfare, insofar as it allows greater precision and discrimination, which it might do, means that you might have to kill fewer people, or those that you do kill, you can kill with greater accuracy. Remember what I said at the start about the machine doesn't feel fear or fatigue, so it might be more accurate. All that relies on you understanding who you've got to target in order to achieve the effect that you want to achieve, and that's a whole different set of problems.
So I think I've understood you correctly when you say that lethal autonomous weapons are producing and will produce significant changes both in the decision to go to war as well as on how wars are waged. But what about the possible changes in how armies are organized? And what about the changes in the role of the military forces within democratic societies for those armies relying on this technology?
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge and important question. And I think that militaries have only just started wrestling with the implications of this. You know, armed forces are conservative with a small c. You know, they're traditional. They tend to do what's worked well in the past. And they're hierarchical. They have many ranks. I think there are 19 or so ranks in NATO armed forces from the bottom to the top. And they're organized into areas of specialism, principally the domains of land, air and sea warfare, and now you add space warfare to that. So they have this traditional structure that's worked well for them in the past. And I think that autonomy, AI, threatens to bring some radical disruption to that structure. Just because it's worked well in the past doesn't mean it's going to work so well in the future. So, for example, armed forces understandably venerate tend to concentrate on and give prestige to the combat arms, the infantry in land warfare, the parts of the army that close with and kill the enemy face to face. In an armed force that's much more autonomous, there's less of that. So who's the leader and who's leading, and in what way are they leading when it's a fleet of drones or a fleet of land robots that's involved in combat? There's going to be some changes there. Do you need all those hierarchical rank structures? Do you need that pyramid of units? Does it still make sense to talk about a battalion of soldiers if you're dealing with land robot units? I think that's going to change in some fairly profound ways. But then, Paolo, the second thing you mentioned there was the relationship to wider society. And there is a connection. There always has been a connection between wider society and armed forces. And I think that there will be, even after we see a lot more AI, but it will certainly look very different to how it does now. Already in Western Europe, a very small percentage of the population ever serves, since conscription has ended and as armies have got smaller and smaller. It's a tiny fraction of people in the United Kingdom, where I'm from, who wear a uniform in the course of their lives. Fewer people know somebody who serves in the military. And I think AI and autonomy will only increase that trend. And there's a danger there of a dislocation, a kind of growing separation and gulf of understanding between wider society and the institutions of the state that carry out violence on its part.
So up till this point, we've been talking about tactical AI, which is a more limited task or platform-specific application of artificial intelligence and a form of the technology which either already exists or is close to development. Let's turn now, if we could, to a more speculative future and this idea of artificial general intelligence, or AGI. Could you tell us a little bit about what AGI is and how AGI, or artificial general intelligence, could change the concept of war and military strategy on an even greater scale?
Yeah, okay. Thanks, Abby. I mean, it's a huge and fascinating question, and it's quite speculative. You know, nobody can really give you a definitive definition of what AGI is, because it isn't here yet, and nobody can tell you when it's going to be here yet. The estimates from those involved in AI research vary widely. Will it arrive out of nowhere very rapidly and move towards what people call a singularity, or will it be something that evolves more gradually over a period of time. I think about the only concrete thing I would say about AGI is it will look very different to human intelligence when it eventually emerges, particularly if it uses computers as we understand them as its architecture, that is the system on which it runs. So if it runs on something that looks a little bit like the laptop I'm recording this on, it will look something very different from your form of intelligence, which is, you know, sitting in a bit of wetware inside your body. Human intelligence is very biologically informed and very socially informed by the groups that we live in. So AGI, I think, will look very different to human intelligence. Nonetheless, if that's the starting point, I think we can start to conjecture a little bit about what, if not AGI, more sophisticated, more general AI than we have today, what that will look like and the way in which that will impact warfare. And that's what I start to do in this last book, I, Warbot, when I'm thinking about AI's potential role in strategy, as you say, Abby, not just tactics, the strategy, the higher business of war, how you think about the larger scale, the longer term, the more difficult, less bounded problems, the problems that look a little bit less like a video game on the battlefield and look a little bit more like a game of poker. Again, as Clausewitz said, you know, strategy is most like a game of poker. You're trying to guess what the other person's going to do. I think we can have some guesses about what more sophisticated AI will look like when it starts to play a role here, because it already is to a limited extent.
Right. Kenneth, if I could dig into one part of that, you said that artificial general intelligence, more specifically, or more developed form of existing artificial intelligence, could in particular have a bearing on military strategy. Could you tell us a little bit more about that, please?
Yeah, so I actually think that the future for artificial intelligence at the strategic level is working with humans as part of a human machine team, so that you can find a way of combining the relative strength of human and machine, the things that humans are good at and the things that machines are good at. We know that machines are good at searching through masses of data and spotting patterns. We know they're good at doing it fast. We know that humans are good at empathizing or using theory of mind to try and figure out what the other side in any conflict is thinking or wants to do. So if you can find a way of combining those two unique selling points of those intellects, then you've got a powerful strategic tool. And I think we're starting to see that. And a good example, one that struck me when I was writing the book, from the non-military sphere, and there's quite a bit of that in iWarbot as well, was this idea of human machine teams for creativity. And the one I remember that I really liked was the ballet choreographer who used artificial intelligence to come up with new routines for his dancers. And he fed hours and hours of footage of dancers dancing to the algorithm. And the algorithm came back with new human movements. It's a highly innovative thing to do. You can also see it being used in other creative avenues like writing. So the new state-of-the-art GPT-3 algorithm that generates realistic human prose. Journalists, writers are starting to use that as a prompt. So it won't be capable of writing a novel off on its own bat, but you can prompt it to come up with ideas that you might not have thought about for the next paragraph or the next chapter, if it's digested what you've written already. And it's that sort of creativity, I think, you can start to see that being applied to thinking about strategy and warfare. And that, I suspect, is the way ahead.
Kenneth, let's now move to a question that we have already discussed with one of our guests in a previous episode, that is Richard Moyes, the director of Article 36, which is the possibility of international regulation of lethal autonomous weapons. In your recent book, you seem to be quite skeptical about the prospects of an international treaty. Can you explain us why?
Yeah. I can do. So regulation, I am worried about lethal autonomous weapon systems. I think there is the potential for them to go wrong, as any complex system can do. And I think there's the potential for them to get our intention wrong, our instructions wrong. And that can be dangerous to anybody on the receiving end, but also dangerous at a larger scale, the more military power these things have, if you think about inadvertent escalation. We have a loose understanding of how humans squaring off against each other might move up a ladder of escalation. We're a bit more in the dark when it comes to thinking about machines. So there's some real danger here from lethal autonomous weapons, and I don't want to minimize that at all. I am, however, quite skeptical about the possibility of international arms control, regulation, even banning lethal autonomous weapon systems, or more broadly, banning or regulating the use of AI in military systems anyway. For one thing, Pandora's box is already open. You know, these systems are here. Machine learning techniques are already used in existing platforms. Artificial intelligence systems are already used, have been for decades, in automatic weapon systems like the Aegis system on US ships that shoots down incoming missiles. They're used in intelligence and surveillance and reconnaissance, and have been for years now to tag and classify information hoovered up by intelligence systems. So this stuff's already here. The second part is it confers such a large advantage, or has the potential to confer such a large advantage on those states that can acquire it and use it, that there's a powerful incentive for them to do so, especially those states that think they're going to be good at it, the technologically advanced states. So they're reluctant to hamstring themselves. And they're particularly reluctant to hamstring themselves because of what theorists call the security dilemma, fear of the other side either not signing up or somehow cheating on the deal and clandestinely working on their own AI systems. And that's a big problem when it comes to AI. It's a problem anyway when it comes to arms control, but it's a big problem when it comes to AI because it's hard to detect these things. If you're building a secret nuclear program, as some countries have tried in the past, there are some obvious things to look out for. You need some fairly chunky industrial equipment, and you need some fairly rare raw ingredients. You don't necessarily need those things with AI. It's just code. You don't even need to develop it yourself if you can pinch it from somewhere else. So states have got just reason, I think, to worry about other sides cheating on any deal that they commit themselves to. And they're also paranoid about how much fighting power that's going to confer on them. If AI really is that important for battle, then you've got to be worried. And for those reasons, I think regulation is up against it. And there's been a lot of talk over the last few years at the UN about what can be done, and there's still no agreement. And I'm sorry to say, I don't necessarily see that situation changing anytime soon.
Well, although I must say that you refer to generally the possibility of an international regulation of the military use of artificial intelligence, although, as you know better than I, in Geneva, the talks are going on about lethal autonomous weapons, namely artificial intelligence weapon system that can take the decision to kill someone without a man in the loop, as we say. So I agree with you that perhaps the discussion is too focused, too limited, since artificial intelligence is used and can be used in a variety of ways when it comes to the military use of this technology. Do you think that it is useful to focus on lethal autonomous weapons in terms of regulation, or is it totally nonsensical?
That's the sharp end of the spear, isn't it? That's the tip of the spear, the trigger puller, the bit that makes the final decision to kill. But if there's AI in the system before that point, then the human is still making their decision on the basis of bounded rationality. So if you're flying an F-35 fighter plane, for example, what's called the fusion engine that brings all the intelligence together and puts it in your helmet, your space age helmet, some of that is provided by machine learning. So you have, in a sense, what a lawyer might call diminished responsibility for your actions if the machine is telling you that this is a legitimate target. I think this this business about the human on the loop, so the starting point is that you should have a human in the loop. That's where everybody started here, that the final decision to fire, the active decision to fire, should be taken by a human. Well, since then, we've retreated as the technology has advanced to the idea of a human on the loop, not in it. So they're sitting there watching what's going on, and then they leap in if they see the machine doing something that's unexpected or that they don't want to happen. That's a reflection of AI's ability to generate mass. You simply, and to operate at speed, you simply can't deal with the speed and the numbers involved to be actively commissioning every decision to fire. If you think again about the swarm, the whole attraction of the swarm is that it's so large that no human can defend against it. Well, if no human can defend against it, why would you slow it down by having humans make every single lethal decision for the swarm? The military advantage of the swarm is that it doesn't work like that. And you yourself might say, well, my swarm, because I'm a good liberal humanitarian, is going to work this way. If your enemy decides otherwise, you lose. You're too slow. That's the security dilemma that I spoke about in action. So now, finally, we arrive at the point of talking about meaningful human control. And this is the fallback option where we are at the moment, where you say, well, if we're going to regulate, it's important to have some sort of meaningful human decision-making in the mix here, because humans can be held responsible and accountable, because there's more dignity, let's say, about a human being involved in lethal decisions than it just being outsourced to a machine. And because humans have this better understanding of context and meaning, as I referred to earlier. So we're talking about meaningful human control. I'm skeptical that an agreement can be found around that term. What does it mean, meaningful human control? Where I am is the idea of a human not in the loop or on the loop, but a human before the loop. It's incumbent on humans to give rules of engagement to the machine so that the machine accurately reflects our wishes and desires, or as close to them as we possibly can. Bear in mind often that we don't know what we want until we suddenly find out that we want it. But I think meaningful human control is just going to be the latest tough line that the technology is going to move past. So as I say, unfortunately, I'm pessimistic about the prospects.
Sorry to disturb, boss. Keep an eye on the time.
Yes, apologies, Ryan. We really need to wrap up. Time is flying by. So can you ask your last usual question to our guest?
It would be my pleasure. Kenneth, what are three adjectives that come to mind when you think of lethal autonomous weapon systems?
Fast, accurate, dangerous.
That was fantastic. It's strangely enough, it's a question that recurs in every episode, and it's a question which frequently causes no small amount of trouble for our guests. So you were right off the bat there, and that was wonderful. Thank you very much.
Great. I'm going to have to go back and see what everybody else said now.
Thank you. This was a wonderful conversation, and thank you for coming on our podcast.
That was a real pleasure. Thanks very much for engaging with the ideas, for sure, and the terrific questions.
Thank you so much, Kenneth, and thank you to our listeners too. Remember to tune in to our next and final episode. And until then, thank you and goodbye.
Thank you for tuning into episode 9 of Lethal Autonomous Weapons, 10 Things We Want to Know with Kenneth Payne. The books and articles mentioned in this episode are linked in the show notes. There you will also find our contact details and a link to our website, where you will find more episodes and read more about our lethal autonomous weapons and war crimes research project. Thank you for listening. Catch you in the next episode, where we will cover the question, will military swarms be the next weapon of mass destruction? Over and out.